pre-release court documents show Yahoo's strenuous legal objections before the FISA court. Apple is set to release its first wearable, but don't call it an iWatch, that just sounds too creepy. And will Minecraft soon be part of the Microsoft family? That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40A&M in 5, the weekly download of 40A&M LLC. It's Monday, September 15th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, in court documents unsealed this past Thursday, it was revealed that the U.S. government threatened Yahoo with massive fines if it failed to comply with federal demands to participate in the NSA's controversial PRISM program. Federal Judge William Bryson, presiding judge of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review, which reviews denial of applications for electronic surveillance warrants, unsealed the 1,500 documents that detail Yahoo's ultimately failed suit against the government to prevent the data handover requested for PRISM. The depth of Yahoo's clash with the U.S. government over the handover of user data was previously undisclosed, and in a Tumblr post this past Thursday, Yahoo General Counsel Ron Bell stated that the released documents underscore how we had to fight every step of the way to challenge the U.S. government's surveillance efforts. A version of the court ruling had been released in 2009, but it was so heavily redacted that legal experts were unable to discern which company was involved, what was involved in the data request, and how the FISA court reviewed the relevant legal issues. Begun under the Bush administration, the PRISM program uses collected information obtained from the major tech companies pursuant to Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. At issue in the original case was the then recently passed Protect America Act of 2007. That allowed the government to collect data for significant foreign intelligence purposes on targets reasonably believed to be outside of the U.S. That law would eventually become the foundation for the FISA Amendments Act, passed in 2008. The order requiring data from Yahoo originally came in 2007, but according to the documents, it alarmed Yahoo attorneys particularly because it ignored a traditional requirement that each target of surveillance be subject to court review before surveillance could begin. In addition, the order didn't stop at metadata, the send and receive and timing information of a communication, but sought email content as well. Once the Yahoo challenge had lost its initial round before the FISA court, the U.S. government threatened to fine Yahoo $250,000 per day while it continued its appeal. Faced with the potential of massive fines, Yahoo began complying before losing its challenge entirely several months later. Added Ron Bell, our fight continues as we are still pushing for the FISA court to release materials from the 2007-2008 case in the lower court. At the time of the ruling in the Yahoo case against the PRISM orders, the Washington Post reports that Microsoft had already joined in participating in PRISM. Eventually, nearly all of the major U.S. tech firms, including AOL, Apple, Google, and Microsoft, were listed by the NSA as participants in the program, according to The Guardian. It is unclear where the addition of Yahoo comes in that list, but as noted by Craig Timberg of The Washington Post, it is likely that Yahoo's forced compliance was one of the first and would likely have been an effective tool in generating compliance by others. The unsealed documents make plain that the program permitted the NSA to order U.S.-based tech companies to turn over emails and other communications to or from foreign targets without search warrants for each of those targets. Other NSA programs, the Washington Post noted, gave even more wide-ranging access to personal information of people worldwide by collecting data directly from tapped fiber optic connections. In the aftermath of the Snowden revelations about the NSA communications surveillance activities, U.S. tech firms have been particularly struggling to defend against accusations that they were willing participants in the government surveillance programs, as the Washington Post reports. An allegation that has been particularly damaging to the reputations of these companies overseas, including with lucrative customers and markets in Europe. Although the ACLU had not yet had a chance to review the released documents as of last week, Patrick Toomey, staff attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project, told The Guardian that it appeared that Yahoo had challenged the warrantless wiretapping program more than any other of its competitors. In related news, the OPM, which is the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, announced last week that it is severing ties with the Falls Church, Virginia-based USIS, a private contractor that provides security background checks for the U.S. government. The decision by OPM not to renew the USIS contract comes after the company was hit in August by a cyber attack that compromised the files of 250,000 Homeland Security workers. However, USIS has also been responsible for security clearance of Aaron Alexis, the Washington Navy Yard shooter who killed 12 people. OPM would later say that the Alexis check had been complete and in compliance. As noted by National Public Radio, USIS had also conducted the background check on Edward Snowden. In addition to the announced launch of the iPhone 6, Apple also introduced us last week to what will eventually be its first wearable technology, the Apple Watch. Yes, you heard that right, there's no I in the item's name. iWatch might have been too difficult for consumers to swallow in a post-Snowden world. As debuted by Apple CEO Tim Cook, the watch is sleek and will become available in three versions: aluminum, stainless steel, and 18-karat gold, at a starting price of $349 in early 2015. Apple has developed a button for the side of the watch, which Apple calls the digital crown, that will turn to adjust functions. No pinching the screen for zooming on this device. The dial will zoom in and out and adjust the time. The screen, what watch enthusiasts know as the crystal, will differentiate between a tap and a touch and will also vibrate with alerts using a haptic feedback component and a tiny speaker. The Apple Watch will measure health and fitness, tracking users' movements, their heart rate, and activity with tiny sensors and feeding the information into Apple's health app and review and analysis of the data by the user. In addition, several of the Apple's apps will be available on the watch, including Siri voice control, messages, maps, and information pulled from calendars, email, and other iPhone apps. Apple's new payment tool, Apple Pay, will also be available on the Apple Watch, permitting users to pay for goods and services in the U.S. using the watch like a contactless credit card. Particularly with Apple Pay and Siri on board of the new watch, users may, for the first time, be able to use the phrase, talk to the hand, without seeming incredibly rude, albeit to some generations, the experience of using an Apple Watch may be too reminiscent of Dick Tracy. Each of the three watch styles will pair using Bluetooth to sync data and will be compatible with the iPhone 5, 5C, 5S, 6, and 6 Plus. The Guardian's Samuel Gibbs pointed out this past week that wearable technology devices have struggled to become mainstream, with few convincing use cases and particularly ugly designs for some devices. At the very least, the sleekness of the Apple design here may have some advantages. With 9.7 million wearables, including fitness trackers and smartwatches, sold worldwide in 2013, according to CCS Insight data reported last week by The Guardian, this number is expected to reach 22.3 million this year. The gadget lovers among us probably won't be able to get enough of this, as Elise Hugh of NPR reported this past week, and Apple is likely counting on the verve and opinions of these first adopters come early next year. Gartner Research has laid out the technology trigger and life cycle that typically comes with first adopters for us. First is a triggering event, then the peak of inflated expectations, followed by a trough of disillusionment, the slope of enlightenment, and once there is some mainstream adoption, if any, the much-sought-after plateau of productivity. But what about watchmakers? Are they nervous? As reported by Businessweek this past week, exports of electronic watches have changed little over the past decade in terms of volume and value, while mechanical watches, which tend to be more expensive than the battery-powered kind, have almost quadrupled in value and tripled in volume. High-end watches particularly are supposed to last forever, and unlike iPhones, iPads, and other tech gadgets, the secondary market for repurchase is robust. Jean-Claude Biver, director of timepieces for LVMH, told Businessweek that the watch market has gone through crises and restructures. It's an industry with a lot of cash, a lot of R&D development, a lot of marketing skills, and a very strong and structured distribution network. Jean-Claude also told the Wall Street Journal that, for his taste, the Apple Watch looks a little cold. It does look perfect, but perfection sometimes has a lack of sexiness. In the Wall Street Journal story, it was noted that the high-end watch market, particularly out of industry-leading Switzerland, has been enjoying a remarkable boom in recent years, with exports collectively reaching $23.3 billion in 2013. Some are speculating that lesser expensive watches, those that sell for $500 or less, could be part of the market's most vulnerable. But added Nick Hayek, chief executive of the Swatch Group AG, the world's biggest watch manufacturer by revenue, everything that makes millions of people open to putting something on their wrist will boost the opportunities to sell more watches. No doubt the Apple Watch will keep really good time. It was noted in this week's releases that the watch is expected to be accurate to within 50 milliseconds. But for the user who is used to calling his or her watch a timepiece, the Apple Watch may not have much to offer. Then again, I've heard few people actually use that term. Will the Apple Watch take off? Only time will tell. Speaking of areas to watch, the BBC reported this past week that the European Union Competition Commissioner, Joaquin Almunia, is looking to seek fresh concessions from Google on how it displays search results on web pages. You might recall that we discussed back in February the deal that had been hammered out between the competition authorities and Google for the firm to reserve space near the top of its European search pages for competitors, which would be open to rivals for bid via an auction. But some complained that the deal would simply provide Google, which has roughly 90% of the online search market in Europe, according to the BBC, with another massive revenue stream via the auction process. Mr. Almunia had previously indicated that he was very happy with the February deal and the changes, but in an interview with Bloomberg TV, reported on by the BBC, he apparently has changed his mind, given harsh feedback. Writing on the Google Europe blog, Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt quoted Mr. Almunia saying that to impose strict equal treatment could mean returning to the old world of Google simply displaying only 10 undifferentiated search results. This would mark the third rejection by the Competition Commissioner of solutions proposed by Google, and according to the BBC, it is unlikely that an agreement will be reached before Mr. Almunia leaves office at the end of October. Swedish software studio Mojang and its founder, Marcus Notch Persson, is reportedly in the midst of a deal to sell the firm to Microsoft for roughly $2 billion, according to numerous outlets last week, including the New York Times, Bloomberg, and the BBC, although the Wall Street Journal was reportedly the first to lead with the story. Mojang is the creator and operator of Minecraft, in which players use blocks to build shelters, cities, devices, weapons, and simulated environments to defend their character against the game's zombies and other monsters. According to Bloomberg, 54 million copies of the game had been sold through June of this year, which for a game only released in 2011, makes it the third best-selling game of all time. Minecraft has since also been released for the Xbox One and PlayStation 4. According to both the New York Times and Bloomberg, if the deal is concluded, Mr. Persson is unlikely to stay with the firm past 6 months, although Microsoft is keen to hold on to the studio's developers. So thorough had been the popularity and mystique of this world-building game that the BBC reports that the Victoria and Albert Museum in London had hosted an evening that explored its design culture. And LEGO has been developing spin-off toys. One gamer recently came up with the extreme example of building a working simulated virtual hard drive using Minecraft tools. The BBC noted that, if concluded, this would be the first multi-billion-dollar acquisition by Microsoft chief executive Satya Nadella. Some gamers are naturally worried about the buy and what it could potentially mean to the product and its huge loyal following. Minecraft aficionados are among the most loyal gamers who regularly tune in to sites like Twitch and YouTube channels to watch other gamers, like the ubiquitous Dan TDM, develop strategies and other novel uses of the game. Certainly, a pairing with Microsoft would help streamline and update Mojang's web-based sales and operations site, which is notoriously clunky, but it also could potentially mean preference for Microsoft systems when it comes to future products. In the wake of this month's hack of celebrity pictures from iCloud accounts, Apple has increased security controls and notifications for iCloud users. Although we should stress that the hack, which was discussed in depth last week, was not apparently due to a breach in iCloud systems, but the result of phishing and related scams used to garner user passwords and IDs. One such phishing scheme involved an email, which appears to be from Apple, claiming that a song has been purchased from iTunes using a user's account but for an unknown device. Once a user then clicks on a link in the bogus email, they are asked for their user ID and password, which are immediately compromised. Any email claiming that online accounts need to be updated or changed should always be suspect, and Apple has additionally increased notifications this past week for iCloud customers to notify them when their account is accessed, when a password is changed, and particularly when an account is accessed by a new device or to reset a device. This emphasis on user awareness and increased security notifications comes as Home Depot admits to a hack of its systems, a hacking that may have compromised user customer data to as far back as April of this year. Security blogger Brian Krebs had been the first to discuss a Home Depot data breach when he alerted in his blog to credit cards and debit cards that had been targeted using malware-infected registers and purchasing terminals running Windows. Home Depot has 2,200 stores in the U.S. and Canada, and as reported by the BBC, Mr. Krebs noted conversations with a number of banks reporting a steep increase in fraudulent ATM withdrawals on customer accounts since the hack was made public, and in addition, noting that card data was becoming available for sale on underground crime shops. Armed with the user's full name and city, plus zip code data on the store in which it was used, which reportedly is among the data apparently leaked in the hack, Mr. Krebs noted that the thieves can then call automated bank systems and change PINs and cards. Home Depot has said that it will begin using chip and PIN payment cards by the close of this year. The U.S. market remains one of the more vulnerable from a security perspective, given that the use of magnetic strips on cards still remains the standard. In related news, The Guardian's Tim Brewster reported this past week that Europol is launching a Joint Cybercrime Action Task Force, or JCAT, to take action against the world's smartest online criminals. Andy Archibald, who is deputy head of the UK's National Cybercrime Unit, has been placed in charge of the team to provisionally be based at the European Cybercrime Center, EC3, at Europol. Austria, Canada, Colombia, Germany, France, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, the UK, and the US have already committed to taking part in a 6-month pilot of the task force, according to The Guardian, and as many as 18 individuals from these countries will initially relocate to The Hague, where the EC3 is based. The workers will gather and share intelligence on cybercrime activity before building cases, which will then be presented to the JCAT board, headed by Archibald, which will then decide on which cases to pursue. According to The Guardian, the group will also seek to form ties with countries in Eastern Europe, where much of today's online crime originates. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 48MN5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 408-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least 2 online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Washington Post, Business Week, The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, the BBC, and Bloomberg Business News. Thank you for listening. 48MN5 will be off next week, but we'll be back with you again on Monday, September 29th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.